Around midnight on April 9th, 2008, Kansas City, Kansas Dispatch received a 911 call from Jeff Rogers. He had been beaten, shot, and stabbed, but used what strength he had left to call for help. He later died, but not before giving police a description of his attackers. It has been nearly 10 years, and Jeff's murder remains unsolved. Jeff's mother, Nancy, and Uncle John have never stopped seeking justice. I'm Charlie, and this is Impact Statement. When a crime ends in a conviction, the victims or their families are often allowed to give a statement to the court about the impact of the crime on their lives. But when these life-altering events go unsolved, do not end in a conviction, or maybe aren't crimes at all, the victims and their families do not have this opportunity. The stories on this podcast are their impact statements. I reached out to Jeff's Uncle John when his name was passed on to me by Marissa, the host of the Vanished podcast. He had initially reached out to her, having heard she covers cases with family involvement. The Vanished focuses on missing persons cases and not unsolved murder cases, so Marissa, always the advocate for families, helped find a podcast for Jeff's story. I generally handle interviews on Skype, but since Jeff's mother, Nancy, lives less than an hour from my home, she invited me over to her home to tell me more about Jeff. John was in town, and after giving Nancy's beagle puppy the obligatory attention that beagle puppies deserve, we talked about Jeff. Jeff grew up in Leavenworth, Kansas, a city on the Missouri River just 4 miles south of Fort Leavenworth Army Base, and not far from where Nancy now lives. He and his brother grew up close, being only 18 months apart. When Jeff was 10 years old, he became a big brother again, this time to twin baby sisters. The last time his mother saw him, he was playing the big brother role to his sister Mary, then 15. This is Nancy.
I remember the last time I saw him. He would come up to the house, and he'd hang out with me in the kitchen, and he'd go out on the deck when his stepdad was barbecuing
and play guitar. And
he'd go back and he'd say, he goes, "Those are some beautiful girls." He says, we got to get Mary to smile a little bit. And he'd go back there and he'd play guitar. And we've got a video we can show you that he'd put his ball cap on backwards and he'd sing a song about his little Mary. And she'd be over there just a giggling. And that's what he intended to do. He was getting her to smile.
Growing up, Jeff's extended family was close, and he enjoyed time with cousins, aunts, and uncles. Fishing was one of his favorite activities, and he enjoyed spending that time with his Uncle John after John moved south to the Tri-Lakes area near Branson, Missouri. This is John.
That's what he loved. He loved the outdoors. He was an outdoorsman. He liked to go fishing. After we'd moved down there, he'd come down and go fishing and stuff like that. He just loved to get away and get the break, get down there.
Jeff was 25 years old and had recently bought his own home in a residential neighborhood in Kansas City, Kansas, just a year and a half before his death. He spent much of his time working on his house and taking time to get away from the city to go fishing. He liked to say, "The women love me and the fish fear me." On April 8th, 2008, Jeff had his best friend over for a cookout. It was a Tuesday evening, and with both having work the next day, they weren't hanging out late.
Kind of what we're thinking, and maybe with the detectives and stuff, that someone was kind of maybe scoping it out because they gave him just enough time to get to sleep, you know, because I think it was, 11:30, he might have went to bed, and then once they see the lights go out, and then maybe give someone a half hour later, that's when it happened.
Around midnight, four or five men stormed into Jeff's house through the front door. Jeff lived in a raised ranch-style home, so as they entered the home, the men would have had to go up several steps to get to the main floor where Jeff's bedroom was located. The brunt of the attack was in his bedroom. He sustained significant injuries, including multiple stab wounds and gunshot wounds.
They don't even think they were in the house for 3 minutes. Jeff's 6'4". He's not going to let anybody come in his house. So he fought for his life. The detective said that they think that he heard him.
I know that he heard him because me and my older sister personally went down to the funeral home, to the mortuary there, and we both went in to see Jeff and seen the wounds and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I looked over at his right fist, and his right fist was black and blue. So that tells me he fought back.
In spite of his serious injuries, Jeff was able to call 911. When first responders arrived, they found him in the hallway. He was able to give them a basic description of the men. They were white, and he did not recognize any of them. Jeff died from his wounds shortly after. When looking at crimes, the idea of victimology, the study of victims, often comes up. In this case, looking at the cause of Jeff being the victim, there isn't much. He lived what would be seen as a low-risk lifestyle. The men did not steal anything, nor does it seem like they tried to sneak into the home. So the purpose of the home invasion, in my view, appears to have been the attack. But the motivation remains a mystery.
Jeff wasn't into drugs. He wasn't into gangs. He really kind of stayed home a lot, you know.
Normal. He was fixing up his home, you know, just doing remodeling and doing things like that in his own home. And he didn't hang around crowds, you know. He just had one friend over and was barbecuing. You know, he had a few other friends, but the only crowds that I would see him go to was like go to the Chiefs games and stuff like that.
Perhaps Jeff wasn't the target after all.
There was a house two doors down from Jeff's that was a drug house. And the neighborhood's a nice neighborhood. Every other house was like a raised ranch. They both had pickup trucks out front. They both had barbecue grills out front.
Could have been a mistaken house, yeah.
And that's what I think. They got into the wrong house. And then Jeff was lit up and ready to defend his home.
Investigators interviewed Jeff's friends, family, and coworkers. They processed the scene, collecting evidence. A footprint was left on the front door, and that was cut out and taken to the lab. The DNA collected at the scene was tested and matched Jeff. No investigation is perfect, and the family hopes that any mistakes made do not keep this case from being solved. Tips have come in over the years that police are following up on, and the family is hopeful that someone will come forward. The odds that all four or five of these men never told anyone about what happened have to be slim. Maybe one of them told a girlfriend or a friend, and the hope in this situation is a change in relationship. A partner will keep a secret like that while they are in the relationship. But if or when the relationship ends, they may be willing to come forward. Another possible avenue is one that is seen often, the idea that there is no honor among thieves. If someone who knows who was responsible for Jeff's murder gets arrested for a lesser crime, he or she may be motivated to give information in exchange for leniency in their pending case. Until this happens, though, Jeff's case remains unsolved. And every time another murder occurs in Kansas City, Kansas, the fear is that Jeff's case moves a little further down the priority list. In December, a new detective came on the case.
We just got a new detective as of December. And he was actually the only one in the last 10 years he actually called and introduced himself over the phone. And that he was going to, you know, can't promise anything, but it's a big file and he's going to take a look at it.
Yeah, the lead detective that was on the case at the time, he's retired. So then it moved on to somebody else. And then all of a sudden they moved to a different department.
Every new detective brings a fresh set of eyes and perhaps motivation to retest old evidence using newer technology. But it also takes that detective some time to go through the case file while still working on their current cases.
We're trying to move on. It is not fair that these guys are out there on the streets and enjoying a cloudy day today or holidays or a sunny day. They need to pay for what they've done.
The homicide of Jeff Rogers was major news in the larger Kansas City metro area of 2 million people. Obviously, getting the word out is important, but there is a price to the family.
Now, one of the things that was really hard, the girls, they missed probably 2 weeks of school. I couldn't go back to work. These guys took more than my son. They took our lives away. And I had a good job. I had benefits, and I could not go back to, I tried going back to work. I was off work for several months. I felt that it was good that the girls got back to school, but they would come home crying because other kids would stare at them and knowing or talking about, you know, because it's like we kind of stood out.
With every major news outlet responding, John became the spokesperson for the family, a task he has taken very seriously in the last 10 years. He researched and applied for the governor's reward, and $5,000 was pledged as a reward for information leading to an arrest. But he didn't stop there. He organized fundraisers and got the reward up to $9,000. The local chapter of Parents of Murdered Children has been a support to Nancy, though as she reminded me, it's a support group no one ever wants to be a part of. Another source of assistance has been the Kansas City Metro Area Crime Stoppers. In talking to Nancy and John, they brought Crime Stoppers up multiple times, having been helpful with the reward, collecting tips, getting a billboard up, and writing press releases for the annual vigils, which all help keep Jeff's case in the media. I don't know about you, but I paused here for a second. I didn't know that Crime Stoppers did more than collect tips and distribute rewards. On thinking of it more, I realized I wasn't entirely sure what all Crime Stoppers did. I got in contact with Detective Kevin Baim, coordinator of the Kansas City Metro Area Crime Stoppers. But to understand what Crime Stoppers does today, we need a history lesson in where it got started. Here is Detective Baim.
So Crime Stoppers actually started in 1976 in Albuquerque, New Mexico. There was a detective down there that had a cold case. It ended up being a robbery homicide of a convenience store. And this college student was there working one night. Two guys come in, rob the place, and on the way out, they shoot this college student with a shotgun. He dies. It was the only night that this particular college student was working. He happened to be filling in for a friend. It's a really unfortunate situation. The detective at the time, his name is Greg McAleese. He's actually still alive. He works as a missionary now in the Philippines. He got this case. And, of course, back in 76, we didn't have all the surveillance and all the type of resources that we have now to help solve the case. So they really didn't have any information. It was kind of a rural part of Albuquerque where this occurred. So the case goes cold. So after a period of about, 4 months or so, there's no tips, there's no leads that come in. So Detective McAleese has this case, really wants to get it solved. So he goes to the local media station, the news station in the area, and he says, "Would you guys film a reenactment for me?" They agreed to film it at no cost, and the detective actually put up money, his own money, as a way of motivating people to call in. He also installed a separate hard line at the time to the police department, separate from calling Albuquerque PD or calling 911. And there's a couple reasons for the money and also the dedicated phone line. Number one, the money serves as kind of a motivator. It's not a lot. You're not going to get rich off providing information to Crime Stoppers, but it's a way to motivate people to provide information. The dedicated hard line to the police department allowed them to keep the information anonymous because people typically don't want to work with the police or they're scared of retaliation or whatever their reasons are. So those two things are a key component to Crime Stoppers. Anyway, within 72 hours of putting in this information and running the reenactment, they had both suspects in custody. They actually received dozens of tips. It was the sixth caller that called in with information that actually solved the homicide. But in addition to that, which was the goal, they cleared like eight other cases unrelated to the homicide. So from that, he thought, hey, man, I may have something here. So he offered to share that with other agencies around the nation. So that's where Crime Stoppers was born and has since spread across the world. There are over 1,200 programs worldwide. There's over 400 in the United States. And they all basically operate independently, but their key operating structure is that they take anonymous tips and they do pay cash rewards in most cases. So that's a brief history. Now, our program specifically, we've been around since 1982 in Kansas City. We're a regional program, so we take tips for both sides of the state line, Kansas and Missouri, and all of our information, again, is anonymous. We've taken over 145,000 tips in our 36 years. We've paid out almost $1.4 million in cash rewards. We've solved over 11,000 crimes, actually made over 11,000 arrests. We've solved over 24,000 crimes, including 634 homicides. So we think we have one of the most successful and you know, better programs in the nation. But there are also some other really good ones in Florida. Indianapolis has a great program. Houston has a good program. So they're all over the United States and basically operate on that same premise.
The Kansas City Metro Area Crime Stoppers program has been a success, and they've been able to expand beyond rewards and tips to include other forms of assistance.
A lot of situations with some of the smaller agencies in the greater Kansas City area, they don't have a public information officer or they don't have a media unit. So sometimes they have difficulty getting the word out, and we are more than happy to help them in any way we can. We also help families, as you mentioned, but we will issue press releases to the local media, and we have a very good relationship with all of the media in Kansas City, television, radio, print, etc., where we will publicize as best we can the particular case that the family or the agency wants to get out to the media. And that hopefully will generate tips. We also have a Scholastic Crime Stopper program that we have in our schools, and we've seen a lot of success with that as well. We've actually been able to intervene in 10 attempt suicides and prevent those through information sent to us, which we think that's really important.
When a family faces a traumatic loss, people often don't know what to say. When the funeral is over and the immediate crisis is over, people tend to fade. Sometimes it's harder to share the memories with each other, so people turn inside themselves. And sometimes, honestly, it's just uncomfortable. But that's not what happened with Jeff's family or with his friends. They get together every April to celebrate Jeff's life and to hold a vigil. But it's not just April.
And every now and then I'll get a phone call from one of Jeff's friends, and they might have been out doing something and maybe had a memory, so they'll call.
2 years before Jeff's death, his nephew was born, and he couldn't wait to take his nephew fishing and mushroom hunting when he was old enough, though that day would never come. Then, less than a year after his murder, his niece was born. They have grown up without Jeff, but that doesn't mean they don't know him or know about him. The family has kept his memory alive.
And then when I get my grandchildren that are 9 and 12, they're like, Grandma, let's talk about Jeff. They wanted to go to the cemetery. Jeff was cremated, but we do have a stone over in Leavenworth by our mom and dad. And we drove over there one day, and we pulled up, and they're like, what are we supposed to do here? And I says, well, you can get out and pray. You can talk. Just whatever you want to do. And they jump out of the car, and Ava, that is 9 now, she was like 8, and she says, I love you, Jeff. I miss you, and I didn't get to meet you, but I really miss you.
His little niece isn't the only one who misses Jeff. Every year, someone in the family or his friend group gets married or has a baby or takes another step in their life, steps Jeff won't take, and steps they always assumed Jeff would be there for.
His friends are getting married and having kids. I'm happy for them, but they want their best friend there. My daughter, his Jeff's sister, just got married in November. And it's tough. It's tough because, you know, he would be there. The holidays, he would be there.
For Nancy, it's a painful walk, but she leans on her faith. Healing for her is a matter of choice.
I don't want any other family to ever have to go through this. It's horrible. And I turn the news on and I feel that in my throat and in my gut, what that family's going to be going through, because it's a shock for probably that first year. It's a numbness. A friend of mine that lost his daughter, he said to me, "We learn how to fake it." And I can put on a smile and I can fake it. But it's a heartache that will never go away. And it is a mother, it's a parent's, it's a family's worst nightmare ever. It's a daily struggle. We said just to get out of bed, but it's my faith, my family, my friends. I've got a good support group that keeps me going. And there's days where I can't get out of bed. But most of the time I do. I choose to make my life the best I can. And I do believe I'll see him again. My faith. And it's just, it's tough. And it's even tougher as we get closer to April. Because it's going to be 10 years, and it doesn't feel like 10 years.
If you have any information on the murder of Jeffrey Rogers, call Crime Stoppers at 816-474-TIPS or leave the tip on their website at kccrimestoppers.com. All tips are anonymous and the reward is paid in cash. For how those of you out there can help, the family is seeking to increase the reward. Information on how you can contribute to this reward will be in the description of the podcast episode. Next week, we will talk to a woman who grew up in a home where there was domestic violence. When her mother died, it was ruled a suicide, but she and her brother believe that it was murder.
He puts in the police report, "My father was never suspect and there was no history of domestic violence." Yet one of the officers at the scene, he had been out on domestic violence calls.
Next week on Impact Statement.